The town may be kind of small, but these folks have big smiles and big hearts. And they know what it is to have simple fun down our way, where old-fashioned singing and homey gatherings make living mighty pleasant.
Are you a David Lee Roth fan, or is that just pure snark?
Yeah, no, I am a fan. My Instagram name, like for 7 years, was, you know how you got to pick a nickname, Fuzzy Balls, and then it has your name. So my name was David Lee Roth, one word. One day I got an email to the band account from the lawyers of the, and I'll now quote, the famous singer, songwriter, author, and actor, David Lee Roth, and basically, what do you want for the name?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll give my idol his name, but you know, we have a meeting, we sign the paperwork together, we take a photo, we start our new Instagrams. But the next day, the lawyers came back and they were such pricks that I got a lawyer friend involved. I don't have a real contract, but there's the agreement signed by me, and I signed it all normal, and he signed it like David Lee fucking Roth.
It was an autograph.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had to actually give him my account. Like I had to clear the photos. I had to delete one by one 1,500 photos. I had to give him the password, which was Panama.
Game's rolling.
Welcome to Abandoned Albums, the documentary podcast where we take a closer look at some albums that may have been forgotten about over time, and some albums you might not even know existed. I'm your host, Keith R. Higgins, and joining me as always is Rob Janicki.
Hey, Keith, how are you?
I'm doing great. I am putting the finishing touches on my electric didgeridoo.
Isn't that view something?
Yes, it is. But I'd rather look at you. You're beautiful, Connie. You know, all the way from Michigan, I've been wondering just what I was doing.
Dale, you've been wonderful. Both Dad and I appreciate it.
Connie.
On this episode of Abandoned Albums, Rob and I are joined in Thunderlove Studios by the Muffs bass player Ronnie Barnett. We talk about the band's 1995 release, Blonder and Blonder, as well as the band's entire career. Stories were told, lessons were learned, and laughs were had. So here's our conversation with Ronnie Barnett.
Speaking of the Muffs.
Yes.
How did you guys come together?
Kim played bass in a band called the Pandoras, an all-girl band in L.A. And Melanie played keyboards in the Pandoras. And I had moved out here in 1989. I'm from Houston, Texas, originally. I met Kim in 86, and we became friends and stayed in touch. It wasn't a romantic thing at that point, but we stayed in touch and sent each other packages and call each other. I mean, I hate to sound like every documentary, but there was no internet then, right? So, you know, you had to kind of work, you know, remember long distance phone charges? Jesus.
For sure, yeah.
So we me and Kim were friends, and what happened was I saw her again in 1989, and it kind of became romantic, and I made the decision to move out here. So me and Kim were a couple during this latter part of her being in the Pandoras. Now Kim, during that time, Pandoras were led by a girl named Paula Pierce, who played guitar and sang. So Kim was always writing songs, always wanted to play guitar, have her own band. What happened was the Pandoras, they had let Melanie go. And a month later, Kim made the decision to quit. I remember at the time, I'm always resistant to change. I'm like, you can't quit. What do you mean you quit? She's like, no, we'll have our own band. She found out I had played bass in high school. You know, Melanie picked up the guitar. Kim helped her out. And we found a drummer, and we were practicing literally a month after Kim left the Pandoras. So we had a place to practice. We had a bunch of songs ready to go. And it was real organic. And as was our entire career. But yeah, I'd say we started playing in September of 1990. We played our first show on January 25th, 1991. And, you know, 7 months later, we were talking to Warner Brothers. So everything happened super quick.
What the fuck? That's incredible.
Yeah. The ascent was quite astounding, because we were bottom of the bill on weeknights. And then all of a sudden, you know, 2 months later, we're like middle of the bill on a weekend. And then we were headlining clubs in LA by that summer. So
you said it was 1990, right? So you had that whole alternative thing happening, you know, bubbling in the late 80s, you know, leading into what happened in 91 and how everything took off. But you were already playing that style of music. Who were some of the influences that maybe helped develop the sound you guys had?
Kim always liked what she liked, and that really didn't change over the years. She liked Mercy Beat. She liked Freddie and the Dreamers. She liked Jerry and the Pacemakers. She liked the Kinks, but only till 67. You know what I mean? Like, she liked the Who, but only till pre-Tommy. We would always get Ramones comparisons. And of course, we all liked the Ramones. Kim liked the Ramones too, but she didn't, I think she really didn't listen to the Ramones past the late 80s. So, but that said, I was always the music fan. I still am. But I was fully immersed in the grunge thing and everything. Here's the thing. I would drag Kim to all these shows. Like, I would drag Kim to see, you know, the Swans and, you know, stuff she hated, but she soaked up some of it. A big influence on us that's not talked about was the Primitives. English band, very power pop, but they had a really fuzzy guitar, that thing going. So that's kind of, I mean, our band, we didn't sit down and say, like, we're going to play pop songs and they're going to be, you know, have loud guitars. And, you know, it all just naturally occurred. But yeah, all those influences kind of came into being with all that.
A flood tide of filth is engulfing our country in the form of newsstand obscenity and is threatening to pervert an entire generation of our American children. We know that once a person is perverted, it is practically impossible for that person to adjust to normal attitudes.
Did you aspire to be a musician when you were growing up in Houston? I mean, was that something you wanted to do?
No. I played in a couple bands in high school. My first band was with a history teacher at our school, and his brother. They were both older than me, and he was known at school as like the punk teacher, right? Because he had sang in a band before. And anyway, we formed, and my first gig was at the high school talent show when I was a sophomore. And we played, this is 81, and we played a Gang of Four song, and we played a Wire song. And
wow.
You know, and we played all day and all the night. But to put it in perspective, the other band on the talent show played Hold On Loosely, you know, by 38 Special. So
of course.
It was different. But yeah, so I was in that band. And then later, you know, a year and a half later, I joined the rival high school band. We were called the Distractions with a Y. And we were a three-piece. And these guys could really play. Like, we would play... people always use the term keggers back then. Yeah. We play backyard parties and we would do, you know, covers of the day. We would play Lover Boy songs and stuff, but we would also play Fire by Hendrix, tons of Police songs. And I realized later Sting is really a big influence on my playing, just like in the pocket and Ooh. Not fancy. My approach to bass is, if you don't notice it, you're doing your job, right? So I was in bands in high school and then I gave it up. I started writing for the local weekly paper in Houston called Public News. And I became a music editor there. And that's really what I thought I would do. I thought I'd be a writer. I'm like, this is great. I get to talk to Sonic Youth and Buck Owens and I get free tickets and I get free records. And, you know, and I slag local bands and they hate me and this is fun. Yeah. And, you know, that's what I thought I would do. But when I dropped everything and moved out here, I was kind of starting over. So yeah, I was not meant to fall into a band, but I fell into my girlfriend's band.
Wow.
And, the rest is history, literally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how did that dynamic work in a band? A romantic relationship in a band seems, well, my only point of reference, and I think the majority of people, would be Fleetwood Mac.
Right.
Artistically, it was fantastic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, we were together 3.5 years and we actually broke up. We knew we were breaking up for a while and we broke up before making our first record. The band was doing well. So we were like, look, we gotta work this out. We're gonna have to like learn to be friends. And I can't say it wasn't rocky at times, but we did know how to piss each other off. There were some uncomfortable times in the van for the other members, you know, and Kim started, her next boyfriend was the engineer of our first record too. So, so a lot of people called our first record like a punk rock Rumors. It's funny you mentioned the Fleetwood Mac. We worked it out, you know, it saved our friendship really in the looking back.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I've been able to maintain some friendships with exes and it perplexes the fuck out of people.
No, there are some people that can't talk, you know, are just like, that's it. I'm done with that person, you know.
And yeah.
Some people, like you're saying, I'm friends with most of my exes too. So,
same, yeah.
I don't even know why. Do you think I'm a mess? Maybe someday without you're gone. When I do as I please, I'm indifferent to me. Am I crazy or have good luck? You're the top.
was Craig Aronson the guy who signed you to Warner Brothers? Because he seems to like touch all these, he has all these touch point bands throughout the 90s that helped shape music. Rob Cavallo, he did the same thing that Aronson did. It almost seemed like a tag team that they both touched so many bands that helped shape, well, many genres really, from the 90s into the aughts. And I know he produced your records as well.
The A&R guy who found us is named David Katz Nelson. And he, Dave had just become a full-fledged A&R guy. He had worked under Roberta Peterson, who has a rich career at Warner Brothers as well. Dave more or less signed the Flaming Lips, even though Roberta got the credit. They made Dave an A&R guy. And then Dave's first signing was Mudhoney, which was big at the time because this is post-Nirvana. So everybody wanted the next big band from Seattle. So Dave signed Mudhoney, and then he signed us. And Dave brought Rob Cavallo in. So we actually had two A&R guys, which is unusual, but it did work for us in the beginning. And Rob, I'm going to take credit and say I'm responsible for Rob having a career because before I love Rob, by the way, Rob's amazing. But Rob, the band Rob signed before us was called Sister Whiskey. Rob was a heavy metal guy. He signed Black Sabbath, the Dehumanizer, Black Sabbath to Warner Brothers. He signed the Metal Blade label, you know, and we made our first record and it was produced by A&R guys. It was produced by Rob and Dave. And, right. And that's the first record Rob produced. Like Rob produced demos and stuff for bands before.
Wow.
Yeah, Rob produced that record, and we get credit in all the Green Day books. Green Day liked our record and signed with Rob. Yeah, first record Rob produced was our first record. The second one was a little record called Dookie.
I'm not familiar with this Dookie you speak of.
Yeah. You might look it up.
Look it up, yeah. Yeah.
It
sold a couple of copies.
It'll be a deep Google search, yeah, but it's there, yeah.
It's an abandoned album we should go at.
Yeah.
Bacteria are plants. But they are not green like the plants we usually see. Some kinds are indispensable.
Your band, the Fastbacks, is another band that, you know, that you, there's such an interesting sound that I don't remember hearing. I even hear a little bit, and this might be sound crazy to you, but I even hear a little Violent Femmes in some of your stuff. That music to me has always been underserved, I think, because it's very commercial sounding. I feel like there is something about that specific style of music that dumbfounded some of the label people. Did you see any of that in your career with the Muffs?
By the time we signed in 92 and came around and were in Warner Brothers, you know, they had an alternative department. You know, by the time we came around, they knew, okay, we pushed this stuff to college radio. And, you know, it was kind of, I don't know how to put it. I don't want to say knew what to do, but, you know, they knew what to work. You know, also at that time, there's videos were huge, right? There was a video department at Warner Brothers. Like, I feel really lucky to have gone through that because, you know, it's a cliche to say it's different now, but it really is. You know, by 2000, that old record business, it changed. And I remember... there was a mass exodus at Warner Brothers in 1995, you know, right before Blonder and Blonder. Mo Austin, the president, left, and all these people left in his wake that had been there for 20 and 30 years. And you know, at the time, I tried to put on a happy face, like, oh, this is, you know, this change, it'll be okay. But looking back, that was huge.
How do you think that exodus impacted the record? Do you think it did?
Actually, it didn't at the time. If you notice, our first record was on Warner Brothers, and then we were on Reprise for Blonder. We moved to Reprise because Dookie had happened.
Oh.
Our management and everything wanted to work with all the same people that worked Green Day, and that means like radio people and the publicist, and so that's why we switched to Reprise. Even though it's in the same, even though those labels are in the same building, you have different people, you know, working that stuff. Mm-hmm. So actually, you know, that record. And I say this in the liner notes, the reissue, you know, it really was our big swing. I don't think we realized that at the time because we never thought about that kind of stuff. That was a plus and a minus in our career. Like we didn't think, you know, Kim always wanted to have her hand in the production and stuff. And, you know, that said, the records, you know, sound pretty timeless, except for some things on the first album, which are of its time. Some of those people became big producers in the 90s, like Rob, as we mentioned, and then sure. The engineer for Blonder and Blonder, Jerry Finn, he's a huge part of Blonder and Blonder. He became a producer. He produced four Blink 182 records, and he produced Morrissey and Rancid and Pennywise after that. So, again, I'll take responsibility for Jerry. Jerry is not with us anymore, but he's a big part of that record. Yeah. So
Ronnie, what you're saying is you're a kingmaker.
Sure. Exactly. Yeah. And, okay. and you know, it has not gotten me rich yet, but, no, we just ended up with these people and it, you know, it's kind of like going down a river, you know, we just kind of took this left and this right and just went with the flow. And, so yeah, Blonder did get the biggest, push. You know, we did a video with the guy who did all the videos for Dookie. His name was Mark Kaur. There's a video for Sad Tomorrow, cost $60,000. You know, it's fun. It's a good video. But, you know, we got to do all those things. You know, we played radio festivals on that tour. You know, we'd be bottom of the bill or whatever. But, you know, they tried. And that same year, too, we got to do Kids in America for Clueless. Now, that's probably the biggest hit single, if you will, even though it wasn't a single, that we ever had. I mean, that song gets played in sports stadiums. It I can always, like, say that to somebody on an airplane and they'll know, you know, don't not have heard of our band necessarily, but they'll know that song. So it was a big year for us. I mean, that really was a big year. We did a lot of stuff. We did TV shows and you know, all that stuff. So that change didn't affect all that yet. It was just as time marched on, it did affect, well, you know, all the labels just kind of like, it became bottom line. It's like, you know, if this record didn't sell, you know, we're lucky we got three records, you know, in 2000, we probably would have got dropped after the first record, you know, when it didn't sell.
When it came to female singers, or just female musicians, were people like, well, we have, you know, female fronted bands, or we have a punk, you know, a punk band, you know, the Riot Girl thing. Like, we have that. Did you run into that?
Yeah, we really didn't. We had a fine, it was a great time when we were on the big label. I always hate when people are like, oh, it didn't get promoted enough or that kind of thing. It's like so many factors have to come into play to make a hit record, right? Or else every record would be a hit. Like, you know, you got to have some timing and luck.
I mean, there's so many factors that do play a role as to what becomes successful and what becomes, you know, less successful. So it can't always be blamed on that. You're 100% right. But it is interesting to see how many artists do, you know, have that view of it.
I always wanted to work at a label. I didn't, again, I fell into this role as being in a band. I just like the person who did the cover on Blonder and Blonder is a woman named Jerry Hyden who still does stuff, but we get assigned her. We have, for that record, we had an artwork budget of $8,000. You know, you can make two records these days, right? Jerry worked with like Van Halen and like Tom Petty and Madonna. She did those covers. Like, I don't know. I was just like, I didn't walk in and work with these people and be like, well, you need to do, you know, you really need to push us. I was just like, wow, what? Van Halen? Tell me some crap about them. You know what I mean? Like, is Madonna difficult? You know, that kind of thing. So, you know, I was just, I loved all that. I loved just hanging out at the label. You know, when Alanis Morissette took off that year, I remember we were in Europe and I came back and Alanis had exploded. And I was just, you know, can I meet Alanis? That's how I would bug them, you know, at the label.
No, that's cool.
Not promoting the records. Like,
we need more radio action. Yeah. No,
I need passes to go see Alanis.
Exactly. we would get a lot of songs placed in TV shows and movies. And what would happen is they would call Warner Brothers and Reprise and say, send us a bunch of stuff. They'd get like, so they'd get like Babes in Toyland and stuff. And they would, we would get the gigs, like, cause we would be, I guess we were commercial to some extent.
How do you feel about that? You, I guess you were okay with it.
Here's the thing. Like by that point, I don't really think it was thought of as selling out. Like this was like 7 years after Neil Young, This Note's for You. Right. We didn't get much blowback for having songs in a Buffy the Vampire Slayer or being in a movie with Billy Crystal.
Good.
Early in our career, we were really loud and noisy, and we had kind of a punk following to a certain extent, and which we still did through our career. But by the time of Blonder and Blonder, I mean, we didn't have many gutter punks, you know, coming to the show. Like we didn't have in 2000, we did the Warped Tour, and like. You know, as you're saying, Rob, I always thought of us as really, you know, if you hear us, you'll like us, you know, being on the Warped Tour, I realized how kind of different we were to these bands. Like we would follow like Anti-Flag, you know, and, you know, the song's called Fuck the Government, you know, and they'd have a big slam circle. And then we would come on and sound like the Carpenters. You know what I mean? like, you know,
punk music, it's got so many pieces to it. And so your band is very melodic and there's so much enthusiasm and aggression and even anger at times. The Muffs are as much of a punk band as anybody else.
I was always proud of the fact that we would play punk festivals, if you will, and power pop festivals and garage festivals. And you know, I always felt we could open for anybody really, you know, and we often did. So no, thanks for noticing, Rob. Kim was an amazing songwriter and like, there's a lot going on in most of those songs. Like that's, I don't know, things just changing keys and back to the original key and forward and back. And that's why we're talking today, really. I you know.
You're right. It is all about the song. And there's so much depth in there. And you mentioned earlier, you know, and I don't agree with you because you're probably being humble. But when you said, you know, your approach to bass playing is if you don't notice it, you're doing it right. But it's the same thing, I think, with, you know, music that has layers. You might not hear them all individually, but if you really listen, or especially if you're listening on headphones, there's a lot of shit happening in it, and you really can appreciate what was happening in the songwriting and the recording process, because obviously it came through on the records as well.
No, thank you, Rob. I'm going to call you for pep talks every now and then.
When you were out opening for X, did they pair you with anybody unusual?
You know, the only odd pairings really were those, the radio festivals where we would be on a bill with, you know, Jewel and... Tonic or, you know, whatever, just bands like that, you know, Sponge. And again, that Warped Tour thing, that was probably the oddest, you know, when you're sandwiched between Long Beach Dub All-Stars and whatever, that was the most kind of uncomfortable. But yeah, as far as touring, especially these major label records, we would go out with a bigger band and then we'd go to Europe and then we'd do a follow-up kind of headlining thing. So all these tours were great. After Blonder, we went out on a tour in a middle slot with Veruca Salt. And it would be the best tour we ever did as far as like camaraderie and just, we fit so well with them. And again, we're in the middle. So everybody's there by the time we go on. And we would go on and just kill, if I do say so myself.
Sure, of course.
And then we'd get to hang around and indulge and not get kicked. You know, when you're headlining, you finish and it's like, get the fuck out of it. You know, you it's done. They kick everybody out. And you don't get to hang around, but yeah. And then we get to watch, you know, one of my favorite bands every night. Touring was always fun. I guess we're lucky in that respect too. There weren't too many bad experiences. The worst experience that I can think of on the Blonder tour, our manager, and we were in Europe and he's like, okay, we're going to tour in this big Winnebago. We're only going to get two hotel rooms. So we're going to switch off nights, but somebody's, a roadie and one of you is going to have to sleep in the Winnebago in a parking lot at night. And that lasted one night for me because I was like, this is not going to work out. And I'm sorry, we're just going to have to take more tour support. And we were not one of those bands that slept on people's floors, you know, for better or worse. We were not one of those bands that played the opening of a garage or played a kid's basement in Idaho. And
I want to go back to Blonder and Blonder for a second.
Yes.
How long did you guys actually spend recording that? In the studio, is it a quick turnaround, or what did Cavallo sort of do to?
There's a that term pre-production. That means like, you know, maybe Rob's coming to practices and you're tightening up the arrangements of the songs. Oh, cut off that part or that. Actually, we never really had a lot of that to do. I mean, Kemp, as you guys heard the record. I mean, our songs are like minute 50, you know, 2:30, you know, and they're all just, they have complete parts, you know, couple of verses, the three choruses, a bridge, solo.
They're tight.
Yeah. Yeah. They're tight. So, you know, by the time we would record these records, there was no hemming and hawing about that kind of stuff. And yeah, as far as how long it took, it's hard to remember, but it probably went on for like 3 months or something. And that's not all just like playing. Like we would always try to record as a band, right? And you know, you get those drum tracks. Basically, that's what would happen. You get the drum tracks, then you start trying to add guitars. You figure out things are out of tune, or you know, back then we're recording in these big studios. We're recording next to Eric Clapton and you know, Sheryl Crow and all these, you know, Roger Waters and you know, Earth, Wind, and Fire. I have great stories about all these things, but
well, don't let us stop.
Sounds like a book in the making.
Anyway, you know, you try to record as a band, and then you record all the songs, and then you get the drums. And Roy was always, I don't want to compliment Roy too much here, but Roy really was not, didn't need a click track, very solid. Wow. You know, obviously there's a few cut and paste things. These are the days of recording on tape. And
sure.
So we do that. And then you just start, you know, you move to a different studio and then start doing, then I would do the bass or whatever. And then the guitar overdubs would start. And
okay.
You know, with that, you start doing guitars and then you like, oh, you know, what's a Les Paul Jr. would sound good on this. So they would like rent a Les Paul Jr. And then like, oh yeah, we should re-record the guitar on that other song because this sounds a lot better. And that kind of stuff starts happening. And then the vocals and then the added, you know, the hand claps and the percussion and all,
sure.
You know, maybe a keyboard here and there. You know, we weren't Emerson, Lake and Palmer. Right. So, but there is little things that starts, yeah. But so yeah, it's probably the better part of 3 months. By that time, it's again, post Dookie. So Rob's basically a producer now, more than an A&R guy, and he's doing other stuff. And so things get put off, and then there's the mixing, and that starts, sure. And that turns into a thing, and then there's the mastering. You know, you fly to Maine and work with Bob Ludwig, you know, all that kind of stuff, and then it's finally ready, and then the album cover stuff, and the.
When you're building these songs, when you're building them in the studio, did you ever get to a point where you get to a point of creative paralysis, where you've done so much, and it's like now the song's not as good as it once was.
Yeah, no, definitely. And again, I am not technical at all. Like I was not, the studio to me was like free lunch. You know, I would hang out, eat red vines. I knew to that, you know, Kim has such a opinion, if you will, on how she wants things to sound and how it's going to be. And she was making the right decisions for the most part. You know, I really wasn't the guy in there being like, can you bring up the bass in this or, you know, the floor tom sounds a little mushy on this. You know, I my ears just are not like, I have two different speakers. You know what I mean? Like I am not. So I would pop in and hear stuff as it went along. And
sure. You're on the phone with the label trying to get tickets to the Atlanta show.
Our I'm Happy Birthday to Me got named because me and Roy went and saw Peter Wolf and we're not there for the mixing session that night. And Kim was really mad at us. and it was her birthday.
there's always two sides to when you're making a record. So it's the recording and all the production that comes with it, all the things you just talked about. Yeah. But then there's the songwriting process. And yes. I know Kim was the main songwriter, right? Two questions I guess I have. Since you guys were so close, was there input into the songwriting from you? At all, like in terms of like, yeah, that sounds good, but what if you do this here? Or were the songs basically completely done, and by the time they got to the studio, you guys just played what she?
Yeah, I'd say both. I mean, we were. I'm downplaying all this, but we were like a band. Like we did.
Yeah.
As you could tell, I like to talk, and Roy too. Like we both, and me and Roy are like music historians, where Kim was not. So she would write something sometimes. I'd be like, you know, that's a Bob Mould song. You know, like, or whatever, you know what I mean? Or like,
yeah,
there would be ideas on how to maybe end something or shorten a solo part or Brit. But she was the songwriter. I mean, she did come up with that stuff. But, you know, yeah. There's a song. She threw me a co-writing credit every now and then. But and that's just like an arrangement thing. Like
that counts.
She didn't have to. And some songwriters would not give you somebody credit for that.
Right.
But Kim would always encourage you, like, you should write songs. And it's just like, I believe that, like, that's something you're born with. Like, I know you can take classes and learn about structure and all that, or have binders like Rivers Cuomo on songwriting and formula and all that. But I really think it's something you're born with or you're not. Like,
there's something that you're born with that translates to the actual, you know, end product. But with your band in particular, and bands who and there are others like it, and this may sound like an odd question, maybe not to you two guys, but you know, part of what made her such an intriguing and good front woman and singer were those screams.
Yeah.
Sometimes people plan that stuff. Every time they do that, it always seems, you know, maybe it sounds forced. Was she just that, like, was it that just that easy for her? Because anytime she belted one of those things out, it sounded like the perfect time for it to have happened.
Yeah, no, not that you mentioned, I know, I have never thought about that too much, but yeah, there's no gratuitous screams, right? There's no screams put there just to put there. They do have a purpose. And, and people were always would be like, she's got the best scream, blah, blah, blah. She must lose her voice. She never lost her voice. Like, she would have nights where she needed, you know, to rest the voice, or, you know, would drink throat coat, was this kind of thing that exists. But the screaming actually is like quite, it's not as loud as you think. She knew how to scream on the mic, and it was actually not that loud. It's not, you know, I wouldn't hear her across the stage screaming naturally. So she knew how to control it. It was just natural to her. It was not.
I don't know. When people force it, you hear it. And I don't hear a forced one at all. I haven't on your records.
Yeah, no, fantastic. I love that take, because I realize not everyone is going to love that, right? Like, but it is a big part of our band. So for better or worse. But yeah, thanks, Rob. That's really nice. Very nice of you to notice and put it that way.
When it comes to Kim's ALS, I don't know anything about the disease. Is it something that, because it seems it was a short time span, like 2 or 3 years. Is that something she'd had for a long time? And like, how aware of it?
Yeah.
I guess, you know, how did that, and I don't mean to pry, and if you don't want to talk about it, by all means.
No. I mean, this is part of Kim's story. It's part of our story now. And people should be aware of ALS and what it is. I probably won't describe it, you know, like a medical doctor, but it basically shuts down your movement and your speech. Your brain is fully on. This is like one of the most heartbreaking things about this disease. And some people live with it for 10 years and you know, and just can't move their hands and stuff. And then with her, it happened. It was very aggressive, and it happened super quick. ALS, for those who don't know, a lot of people know it as Lou Gehrig's disease. She had it ran in her family. Her father died of it in his 50s as well. She had an aunt that died of it. It can be, yeah, it can be hereditary to a certain extent. But how it went down, we basically took a breather because our career was just tour, write, make a record. You know, just we were on that treadmill you hear about.
Sure.
For 12 years. So we didn't say like, let's take a break, but it ended up being a break. And we came back and worked the next 10 or 12 years. But so what happened was we went to South America. This would be April, 3 years ago, this last April. Or no, 4 years. I'm sorry. Five. Anyway, whatever. We did these gigs in South America, which were amazing. We finally made it there, and it was, they love rock and roll. We played to 1,000 people at gigs, and they loved. Anyway, we did these gigs, and basically, she had a bunch of songs written for what was going to be our next record. But we were going to take the summer off. She was going to write. We're going to take a breather. And cut to August. She picks me up. We went and did a podcast with our friend Bruce Duff, and she tells me that she can't grip with her left hand. And she's seeing doctors and she's getting diagnosed with this or that, but she couldn't play guitar anymore. And you can hear us on this podcast. We start talking about it and you hear me. She's like, I'll be all right. And I'm like, I'm very concerned. And of course, I wasn't thinking ALS at this point. It was always in the back of her mind. She was scared of getting it because of the family, her father and stuff. So that would be August. So October, she gets diagnosed and a doctor says, I think it's most likely ALS. The doctor didn't know her family history. So she called me and Roy on a group call and told us, and we're all crying. And you know, at this point, she's still speaking normally, but she's, you know, starting to have a little more trouble getting upstairs, that kind of thing. We had booked a gig. We got offered a gig to open for the Dream Syndicate, actually two gigs, Los Angeles and San Francisco. And we're like, okay, we'll do it. You'll just sing. We'll get our friend Adam to play guitar. But by a month later, she was slurring and, you know, we had to make the decision to pull out of the show. Now at this point we're like, okay, we're going to finish what was going to be our next record. She had some demos, for this record and some of them were just acoustic guitar. She actually didn't do these fully or almost fully realized demos like she would do in the past. We kind of learned them all as a band. We'd started playing a lot of these songs already. So we decided, okay, we're going to make this record and we're going to have to build around these demos because she can't play guitar and she can't sing anymore. Again, at this point, she's just having trouble getting around, slurring. So we went in and Roy recorded drums to these demos. Now, these demos were not to a click track or anything for the most part. So Roy had to kind of adhere to some weird timing stuff here and there. And of course, once we started kind of working on the record, you can move with Pro Tools, you can move some stuff around and tighten stuff up or whatever. But this is the record that became No Holiday. Roy's doing the drums in December. By March, Kim can't move and she can't speak. And she had a machine, like an iPad, that would read her eyeball. She could construct sentences. The machine would talk for her. So Kim oversaw the production, us finishing this record, which became our final record, No Holiday. And our friend Karen engineered. I'd be in the house. Kim would be like giving us direction from one room. We'd be in the room with the Pro Tools and the recording stuff. I did bass on everything. We did background vocals. Again, all those little things you add at the end of a record. And Kim oversaw this record. And Kim, I can only imagine, I mean, this device really was like her voice. And she could do things. She could go on the internet, blah, blah, blah. You know, people that had ALS, like Charles Mingus died of ALS in the 70s. Like, it's heartbreaking. But I mean, it's really like at that point, like he just was in his own head. I just can't even imagine.
Yeah.
So it was it was very aggressive and it happened super quick. And I got to say, seeing her, I would just go there. She could still smile, though. And when I would see her, I'd make her laugh. And I'd walk in and the machine would say, you know, your girlfriend has a hairy pussy, you know, and she'd smile. And so she was still in there. You know what I mean? But just seeing that happen to somebody that's so close and I can't stress enough how much of a family we were. you know, as someone put it once, like, I didn't play bass in the Muffs. I was in the Muffs and played bass. And there's a difference in it. And
huge.
You know, and yeah, and eventually everything, like, again, everything shuts down. So sure. Eventually, as always, or as a lot of, you know, the breathing goes. So and she chose to be private about this while she was sick. So I'm a little fuzzy on it now, but it was no more than like a year and a half that she, from top to bottom, getting diagnosed and just, it was tough.
Well, I'm sorry to hear it. Thanks for sharing. That's thanks for being open.
No, of course. And you know, she would have been the attention she got after she passed away. Just none of us could see that coming. Cause you know, we weren't a big band. You know what I mean? Like we weren't a household word, which is why I'm on Abandoned Albums right now. you know, but like, you know, Elvis Costello made a statement praising her songwriting and The Who put pictures of us on the screen at the Hollywood Bowl.
Oh, wow.
It really is the cruelest thing that can happen to somebody. I mean, we were so proud of that record. And, you know, she was still around when we were setting up the release of it. You know, she ended up passing away 3 weeks before it was coming out. So we were already doing press and we were kind of saying like, well, you know, we like the feel of these demos and we just wanted to make this record a little different. And we'll never know how that record would have been received if people just saw it as like the next Muffs record. Cause we were like, what do we say? And we're the kind of like, but Kim got to see it, you know, she got to see finished copies and everything. And
good.
Again, I mean, the record was always going to be a tombstone of sorts.
The story is such a sad story. And I think what you said at the end though, is you guys being a band's band, it is fitting. It doesn't surprise me one bit. I think that shows just what an impact, you know, she had and the band had on some of these people, and you might not have ever even known it, you know?
At when I eulogized her, I had mentioned the Costello and the Who thing. And I said, and I'm going to cuss here. I said, I don't know where all these motherfuckers were when they were taking us for granted. But,
Yeah.
Good for you. Yeah. Good for you.
You know, cause we never really we had this like 27 year career. And we never really, like I said, we took a slight break, but we never really went away. So we weren't able to come back.
As you drive down from Minnesota into Wisconsin, you're in another perfect vacation land. A land of trees and lakes. It was beside one of those Wisconsin lakes that I finally made up my mind to speak to Connie.
Oddly, I want to hear about the Earth, Wind, and Fire stories. I think anybody else.
Basically, that story is a short one. I passed by Maurice White just in the studio. I didn't expect to see him. And there he was.
That's the story?
That's it. But I can tell you but there's a Roger Waters Ugly Kid Joe story.
Oh, wait a second. No one has ever said Roger Waters an Ugly Kid Joe.
Not in the same sentence, ever.
No one. Except you, maybe, before this.
Studio called Devonshire. Roger Waters is in the big room, and Ugly Kid Joe's in the next room. And apparently, the singer, I forgot his name. He's got a good name of Ugly Kid Joe.
Whitfield Crane.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's a good name. He just walks in, and if you record in big studios, you don't just walk in a control room where you don't belong. This guy just walks in, and Roger Waters and the producer are sitting there and just sits down. He's like, hey, what's going on? And Roger Waters just turned to him and is like, get the fuck out of here. And he did. When we got signed to Warner Brothers, going back to that, we didn't have a demo or anything. So we got signed to a demo deal first. So they put us in a studio to do a demo, which was Sound City. Next to us during those 3 days we were in there was Masters of Reality mixing one song. I love Masters of Reality, but that's when Ginger Baker was in the band.
Oh, wow.
We would pass by Ginger Baker. I saw him arrive at the studio in his big piece of shit Ford truck. And we got to be on a nodding basis. I didn't approach him, but he did say something to Kim. Kim was outside in the lounge and like writing something. And he came up and goes, writing a hit there? So Ginger Baker was okay to us. That's a story.
Yeah. And he never did say
that's a rare thing.
Yeah,
to
no,
say,
exactly. Exactly.
What are you working on now?
I consider myself retired. You know, if Pat Benatar calls me, I am available. But I will entertain an offer, but I think that's done. But you know, the band legacy continues. We just reissued our fifth album, Really, Really Happy, on Omnivore again, just last month. So that came out as a 2-disc set and various vinyl configurations, and you know, so things still continue. I don't know what we'll do next, but we'll keep releasing other stuff.
Are there any undiscovered treasures? Is that did Kim happen to have a vault?
I don't think there's a lot. We don't really know what's on our computer. If there's anything, I don't think there's a lot. I mean, I can say I don't think there's a lot.
Maybe a documentary at some point.
Yeah, somebody started a documentary on us back when Whoop-De-Doo, that was came out in 2014. Around then, and actually shot some stuff. He's got some footage, and when Kim passed away, he got in touch with me. He's like, you know, we should really revisit this. And somebody's doing a tribute record, and I was like, look, I don't want to be involved. I didn't want to get involved with asking bands or getting friends involved. I just didn't want to do that. But we'll see how it comes out. I mean, on YouTube, 2 years ago, it's in two parts. Literally 40 Japanese bands did Muff's covers. It's like four hours. It's astounding, and it came out of nowhere. Cool. And there's videos of every song. So we are still talked about and appreciated, and
of course,
yeah,
and for very good reason.
Yeah,
we're like a description. Bands are described as Muffsy and all that now. So
those songs do need the life needs to continue.
Absolutely,
the songs need to stay in front of everybody and get them to. I hope that whatever is next, you know, I hope that gets out there.
Thank you, and it will. I don't consider myself in the game anymore, and at this point, the way things are, it's kind of it's a relief in a way, but it's nice to have this like being this legacy band and still that the work will continue. So thank you.
Awesome.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time. This was great. And thank you again for sharing the story about Kim. That I appreciate.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I don't mind talking about it, but, it is. That's what happened. So,
well, thank you. Thank you again.
No, thanks you guys. This was fun.
Yeah. And, thanks Ronnie. It was awesome.
Okay. Yeah. I will, right. You know how to find me if you need me.
Absolutely. Thanks Ronnie.
Yep. We will.
All right.
Thanks Ronnie.
Thanks man.
Take care.
Okay.
Alrighty.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Many thanks to Ronnie Barnett. The songs you heard during this podcast were all taken from the Muffs' 1995 album, Blonder and Blonder, and they were Sad Tomorrow, Won't Come Out to Play, and I'm Confused. Blonder and Blonder, as well as the entire Muffs catalog, is available to stream wherever you stream your favorite music. Abandoned Albums was recorded at Thunder Love Studios.
Produced and written by Keith R. Higgins and Rob Janicki.
Engineered and mixed by Steve Beasley. Edited by A.J. Royce.
Original music by Mike Pellegrino. If you like what you've heard, be sure to subscribe and follow us on social media. At Twitter, we are at Abandon Albums, and on Instagram, we are at Abandon_albums.
As always, thanks to Rob Janicki, S.W. Loudon, Peyton Janicki, Nathan Sage, Steve Beasley, Mike Pellegrino, Therina Bella, Michael Janicki, and of course, our executive producer,
Rufus Thunderlove.
And now, until we meet again next time, I remain as always obediently yours.
Abandoned Albums is a production of Pawprint Media.